This audio program was made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us at carnegiecouncil.org. Thank you for listening.
I'm Devin Stewart from the Carnegie Council, and I'm sitting here with Jack Maher, adjunct professor at NYU Stern School of Business in Shanghai. He's based in Shanghai and teaching a few courses on the Chinese economy and contemporary Chinese economic issues, as well as a course on marketing. Jack, thank you very much for coming to the Carnegie Council today.
Devin, it's my pleasure to be here with you today in New York, and thanks for having me.
Jack, tell me about your courses. What are sort of the main themes you teach in your classes?
Well, I think the two courses that I've been focused on are a bit different. Marketing is more of a toolkit for marketing, looking at all the basic issues from research to product innovation to channels and sales. So that's something that doesn't necessarily have such an enormous Asia component, although I do structure the course to do all the casework and all the examples and all of our field work to be focused on China and hopefully increasingly on Asia as well. Whereas the Chinese economy course is very much focused on China. It's looking at a number of some of the cutting both macro and micro issues that are affecting China itself, that are affecting particularly U.S.-China relations on the economic front and insofar as they also play out on the political front. Look at it in terms of microeconomy, from how it affects individual corporations. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of U.S. and other foreign companies, from Fortune 500s down to small to medium-sized enterprises that are entering the market that face a whole wealth of challenges that they haven't encountered before. And on the flip side, you have many Chinese companies who, with their global ambitions. So those are some of the major issues. And then, of course, there's a lot of policy issues, particularly right now, ranging obviously around the currency, the value of the renminbi, also around intellectual property has been an ongoing source of concern for the U.S. and other countries vis-a-vis China, and then a wealth of other issues such as WTO enforcement that play out more on a policy level.
So your introduction to marketing class, is it for non-Chinese students?
Well, I'm actually teaching it. I also teach it with Webster University, the first American university to set up an MBA program in China, and that's primarily teaching to Chinese students, Chinese MBAs. And when I do that one, which I do sometimes, usually once a year, so I'll teach that course, it's much more of a sort of, this is the American model for what we see as some cutting edge ideas in marketing.
And tell me about some of those. What do people need to know?
I think probably in marketing for Chinese companies, the two of the major issues are distribution. Distribution still, I mean, if you look at the U.S. and the amount of containerization, the amount of sophistication, retail consolidation, China is nowhere near up to the same level. So Chinese companies are very much looking at learning a lot of distribution and logistics from U.S. companies. But then probably on the more creative side, more interesting side in many ways is branding. I mean, if you look at the top 100 brands in the world, there's no Chinese brands, whereas China's number two, number three in terms of purchasing power parity, probably number three economy just in terms of GNP, you would think that they would be stronger. And this is Japan, I believe, has five or six of the top 100 global brands. Samsung is up there, and it starts to fall off after that. So this is definitely, in terms of innovation, somewhere where China is very much looking towards the future. For example, this month in Fast Company magazine, there was a cover story about how China is trying to be much more of a powerhouse on the design and sort of the creative side of businesses. And you see it a lot on the small to medium-sized enterprise.
So how long until we see a recognizable Chinese brand?
Well, I mean, you have Lenovo, right, which is increasingly becoming a well-known word, at least among people who are sort of paying attention to either the PC industry or what's happening with China. And you have Haier, which is well known among college students and Walmart shoppers at this point. Huawei, more in the telecoms field, and ZTE and some other companies that are much more on the business-to-business level. But in terms of a powerhouse brand, I think it's still going to be some time. And it may be in something
that's... 5 years, 10 years?
I think it's hard to say because I don't necessarily think it's going to be in an established old economy type of business. It could very well be in something having to do with the internet or something very new economy in biotechnology, something where there's a space to be carved as opposed to going in and consolidating existing business simply because the only way to do that is basically through M&A, which is what Lenovo tried doing by buying IBM's brand. But I still think they've got a ways to go to be a leader compared to someone like Apple, for example.
What's an internet business that might have some promise?
I think the Chinese culture is very open to social networking. They have companies like Thousand Oaks, Zhou Chen doing this business out of Beijing. That's, I think, very susceptible. QQ is another one based out of Tencent. QQ is another one based out of Shenzhen. There's the proliferation of Chinese internet users is growing much faster than it is anywhere else in the world. Another statistic is that sort of Chinese internet savvy youth in between ages of 15 and 25 spend far more time online than their counterparts in the U.S., Europe. So when that generation comes of age, and a lot of them are coming from wealthier families, from the haves coming out of the whole economic reforms, and getting very top-end education, whether through good Chinese universities or through foreign universities, I think there's going to be a lot of innovation, and that's why marketing is a subject that's highly in demand.
Well, you mentioned in your syllabus here an issue that we'd be very interested in here at the Carnegie Council. I'd like to talk to you about some of the ethical issues facing China. And right now, just on the topic of marketing, you mentioned that your course addresses ethical issues in marketing. What are those issues?
Well, I mean, I think in marketing, a lot of it, again, revolves around intellectual property and branding. And this is something that's growing. I think China faces a sort of a dilemma in terms of being able to build a powerhouse brand. Because if you do something through acquisitions or through copying, obviously you can grow much faster and sort of propel yourself in terms of at least your balance sheet and your statistics to being something that's a globally recognizable company. But you're not necessarily building the sort of organic knowledge that it takes to become a real powerhouse company. So, I mean, I think in a sense that's definitely an ethical issue. On the side of pure copying and intellectual property violations, again, as Chinese companies move up this ladder, they're going to have more and more patents, more and more trademarks that they actually have to protect, and it's going to definitely become an issue. And there's also a big problem that's widely recognized with fake goods, flooding consumer markets and business-to-business markets. Again, it's a way to increase sales volume and to make money, but it's not necessarily going to teach you how to be an innovative company. And that I believe is an ethical issue in itself in terms of just being good at what you do.
Absolutely. Is China making progress in IPR or fake goods? And what is progress? I mean, that's a tough question.
It's a very difficult question. I think there's definitely an increasing awareness of it. The amount of enforcement tends to be very sporadic. You don't see any sort of really wholesale enforcement. There was a complaint lodged with the WTO very recently. The U.S. has become active. The Bush administration actually stepped in on this issue, particularly, but you haven't seen a great deal of reaction. On the other hand, the Chinese side is getting more sophisticated at using lawyers, using patent lawyers, and using trademark lawyers and being able to fight these cases. So I think as their vested interests become greater, that they're going to that they will make progress in the long term. I mean, there's another argument is that the entire Confucian culture is in many ways based on first mastering what the masters did before you try to innovate, and looking into the past. And I think that's a strong cultural argument that you can make. And in some ways, you saw this with Japan as well, trying to get up the learning curve before you really start to produce, as opposed to seeing a canvas and throwing paint on it and being a very avant-garde and trying to innovate from square one. There's a definite difference in philosophy there.
You mentioned earlier some of the winners get to take part in shaping this new China. New economic power and presence in the world economy. You mentioned also in your syllabus that you talk about the winners and losers coming out of economic reform. What are some of the biggest issues that you've found in that area?
Well, I think clearly the biggest issue, if you're talking about China per se, is that since the reform started in the late 70s, it brought 400 million people out of poverty. 400 plus million people. It's amazing. It's greater than the population of the United States. It's probably the fastest sustained economic growth in the history of the world.
Is that number reliable?
Well, the number's growing too. It grows consistently. Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to come up with a precise number, but I think if you just look at the wealthy parts of China, if you look at the East Coast, if you look at the Bohai area around Beijing, if you look at the Pearl River Delta, and then parts of Western China around Chengdu and Chongqing that are increasingly becoming wealthy, then the number is within the correct order of magnitude. That's for sure. But on the other hand, you still have the other 800 million who are haven't necessarily gained from this. I think one of the biggest A good statistic I saw that McKinsey came up with recently, about 2 years ago, was the differential between the poorest part of central London compared to the poorest part of England, somewhere in the north. There's about a sort of a 10 to 15% differential between their per capita income. Whereas if you look at it between central Shanghai and the rural parts of Guizhou, which is a very poor and mountainous agricultural province in the southwest, the differential is like 600%.
Well, isn't that a huge risk?
It's a very big, yes, and that's where it comes down to. There's political risk there. There's country risk, and there's inequality. It's quite clear.
Does the government have a moral duty to address that?
Well, they have a duty on every level, and the moral level is perhaps the most abstract. But there's a clearly pragmatic reason to address this issue. I mean, China's been around for 5,000 years, and they've gone through this dynastic cycle of basically widening wealth gaps many times. With each time, there's been a transition. I think Hu Jintao's regime and Wen Jiabao with it's called the Xi Jin, the Go West policy. Which has tried to divert capital for both foreign direct investment and government infrastructure investment in both in facilities and education, other key aspects to having a developed society, has made some measurable progress. If you look at for example, the amount of roads being built in China, a lot of the investment is going into places like Henan in central China, which has traditionally been a loser in the reform process. But that being said, it's a massive undertaking. I don't think there's any clear solution to bringing such a massive amount of people out of poverty. In some ways, the easy part is done. Some of the hard part still remains. It's not going to happen overnight.
What about food safety? I mean, a lot of Americans want to know about food safety. This is going to probably be a trade issue mm-hmm. going forward. And on one hand, you have to protect the safety of food. On the other hand, people could say, you know, they could accuse people of protectionism. You know, this is under the guise of shutting out Chinese goods, for example. What do the Chinese people feel about the safety of their food?
Well, I think it's increasingly an issue. I mean, actually, a long time ago, I used to be with the USDA, with the Department of Agriculture, in Shanghai in the mid-90s, and it was something that we looked at to try to bring food safety awareness issues into China, and made some of the first efforts. And at that time, there was very low level of awareness. Again, it's something that goes hand in hand with wealth, and it's definitely growing. I mean, I remember we went when I was with USDA, and I think it was 97, we went to see one of the, I think it was the first organic farm in China, and it was on the outskirts of Shanghai, and it was to supply, at the time, five-star hotels and very high-end businesses. Now there's a number of supermarkets that offer this sort of produce, but still, again, if you're living in at the global poverty line, you're not so worried about organic foods.
Do people demand quality, safe food?
Yes, wealthy people do. But I think there's two views in terms of food safety. One is this very traditional view, and a lot of fairly wealthy Chinese people do not eat out very much because of they don't believe that there's a lot of food safety. It's something that they want to control themselves. You know, when you wash your vegetables with clean water, with bottled water, you control it, and you control your kitchen, you control the food safety is sort of the philosophy. It's a very traditional attitude. Obviously, younger people who are busy, don't have as much time, they have to eat out more. And there's definitely an increasing awareness. I think it's definitely lagging behind, Japan, for example, which is maybe leading the world, Europe, America. I think the issue is increasingly growing, and even in the States, I think that in urban centers you see more food safety awareness than you do in more suburbanized areas. I think it's very much income driven. In terms of the export side of it, it's very much let the buyer beware. I think. It's something that has to be clearly enforced by both sides. And it could clearly become a trade issue. It already has with Japan to some extent, and with the pet food issue recently, that's obviously there would be repercussions for that.
You've been visiting China, living in China, working in China for over 10 years, more than 10 years. What is the biggest change you've observed, particularly in Chinese society, with regard to social issues?
I think there's, in terms of social issues, there's a gradual transition, which I'm starting to see, which I'm hopeful about. I think when I first started spending time in China in the early 90s, there was an idea that any social issue was the province of the government, and if anything went wrong, it was because the government wasn't living up to their expectations. And there was a paternalistic hope that the government would take care of everything. And I think that as China's decentralized in many ways and let markets and other openings start to play their hand out in social issues, not just in economic issues, which, you know, obviously they're related. There's been a phase of clear disillusionment with government and a lot of materialism. But I think I'm starting to see with a lot of younger people, there's also there's more of a sense of social awareness of people being of looking more towards social issues. I think NGOs are going to continue to grow. It's something that's going to take time.
What's causing that awareness?
I think it's a lot of it's income. There's people who it's obvious who the haves and have-nots are. I mean, much more than in a developed, you know, you have people who are very poor. One example that really impressed me is a group of MBA students, Shanghai MBA students. When they graduated, they have their own initiative. They went out to Guizhou, which is this province I mentioned before, and they found one of the poorest areas, and they negotiated with the local government to get a building, and they came back to Shanghai, and they raised about $100,000 in capital to start a school for underprivileged children. And there's not really any tax incentives to do this. It's sort of a very traditional style charity project. And you hear more and more examples of things going on like that. And I think that in the U.S. in many ways works this way. So that's something that I think that will definitely improve. On the bad side is which is related, is the wealth gap. It's become increasingly extreme. I mean, the difference between being in central Shanghai and being in a place like Hunan is striking. I always encourage people to make sure they see more than just the glittering jewels, to get a sense of really what's happening with the Chinese economy, also with all the social issues that follow.
Jack, we have time for one last question, and I want to get to something a little bit more playful. You have this phrase in your syllabus. I'm sticking to your syllabus here.
Okay.
So I'm a very good student. Is you're going to tell us where China is going. Describe to me in a very short way, maybe one paragraph, describe China in 10 years.
In 10 years, assuming that there's no force majeure that derails the entire project of economic development and globalism, which should affect more than China, I think you'll see something, that number will go from 400 million up to 600 million or higher. There's going to be more and more haves in the society, and it's going to create more and more a sense of social awareness. People are also going to be more sophisticated. I think you'll definitely see far more sophisticated Chinese actors on both the economic and the political front. but again, there's going to continue to be have-nots, and there's a lot of social issues that have to be dealt with, I think, by a cooperation between the government, the Chinese government, the economic actors, and all of the increasingly global players, both in the developed and developing world, who are now affected by China's reforms.
Thanks very much for coming by, Jack.
It was my pleasure.